Good afternoon, everyone. Many of you are still getting your lunch and still eating lunch, but we're going to get started because of the tight schedule, and we really want to hear from our speakers and panelists today. We're very fortunate to have a real high-quality set of speakers, starting off with Britt Staley and Rick Duke. First thing I'd like to say is welcome on behalf of the CSIS Energy National Security Program. I'm Guy Caruso, for those of you who I haven't met. I'm a member of the energy team here at CSIS. And Frank Verastro, who heads the program, is away today, but he sends his regards to all, and thank you all for coming. I know it's a Friday afternoon, but given the crowd that's here, I think it speaks how either about the good lunches that CSIS serves, or more likely the topic of the linkage between technology and energy security, and the expectations, I think, that the next years to come are going to lead to significant developments in those areas. And that's what we're going to talk about today. CSIS was very fortunate to partner with the World Resources Institute earlier this year on a project that I hope all of you have picked up a copy of, the roadmap to a secure low-carbon energy economy, and in particular the paper associated with that, Evaluating Energy Security Implications of a Carbon-Constrained U.S. Economy. And that's what the first speaker is going to focus on today. Britt Staley is one of the people at the WRI who really worked very hard and contributed an enormous amount to this project, along with Sarah Ladislaw from CSIS, who will moderate the next panel. So, you know, Britt's going to give us an overview of the paper that you all have had the opportunity to pick up. So we'll really look forward to that. And then following Britt's overview, Rick Duke has recently been appointed by President Obama as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Policy and International Office at the Department of Energy, responsible for climate policy. And as we heard just yesterday from both the G8 and Major Economies Forum, that the President and his fellow leaders, and not only in the industrialized countries, but the largest of the emerging economies, all made a political commitment to move this process forward. And I think, you know, there were perhaps unrealistic expectations. Anybody was thinking that any specific targets, but the media seemed to play it as a disappointment. I think it actually was more of a necessary step in the long road, not only to Copenhagen in December, but beyond that. And that's, I think, why it's so important that the work that Britt and Rick are doing and will be doing can contribute to the process. And we know it's going to be, as the President said, it's going to be difficult, and therefore the guidance from institutions like CSIS, WRI, and policymakers like Rick and the team at PI, where I was fortunate to have spent 20 years of my career. So my support is with not only you, Rick, but your team, because I know it's going to be an exciting time leading up to Copenhagen and beyond. So without further ado, Britt, thank you very much for the work you've done. Thank you for coming and sharing with us today. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Guy. And I just wanted to also thank CSIS, our colleagues, Matt, Jennifer, Brendan, and others for hosting yet another one of these joint events. As Guy said, I'm going to walk you all through some of the analysis that we did earlier this year in preparation for the release of the roadmap for a low-carbon energy economy, an energy-secure low-carbon economy. And this, in particular, is evaluating technologies that can help achieve both climate mitigation goals and energy security goals together. So in part of our efforts in developing this roadmap, we produced a few briefs and working papers, some of which were outside on your way in. If you want to get other copies, we have them on our website, both of our websites, and we have copies around, so you're welcome to them. But as I said, in this brief, we tried to evaluate technology options for a carbon-constrained future through an energy security lens in order to identify those technology scenarios and technologies, technology and policy choices that can help us address these challenges together. So we started out to identify what factors are important for energy security. We obviously, there are a number of definitions and metrics of energy security out there already. We took a number of elements of those and kept those. We left out some, and we added some more that we thought were particularly important. And we arrived at these 11 factors. I won't go through them in too much detail, but we have diversity of energy sources for both transport and for power generation. For that, we evaluated the percent contribution of each technology to the energy mix. Import levels, another important factor. We're not anti-trade, but in fact, clearly energy trade provides a number of important access benefits, but we do recognize the reliance on imports can be a source of vulnerability and clearly is a hot-button political issue that gets a lot of attention at times. So for this, we evaluated the overall oil, gas, and total energy consumption as a proxy because the modeling results that we used were lacking production data to use for that. Security of trade flows, another critical factor. Again, we used consumption data as a proxy because we were lacking sort of the geographic distribution of production information out to 2035. The risk of nuclear proliferation. For that, we used the total level of nuclear generation in the technology mix. Affordability. Energy affordability is a critical component of energy security, and we measured we evaluated the total cost of the scenario for that. Energy intensity. The extent to which you depend on significant energy resources for economic productivity obviously impacts your economic security. And so without economic data, we again evaluated consumption as a proxy for that. Feasibility is another one. If you're relying on certain breakthroughs or unreasonable assumptions about technology deployment and the pace of that, this can have knock-on impacts for other energy security factors that'll be important. So, and then finally, the ones in italics here, we did not evaluate per se quantitatively because we were lacking appropriate metrics for that, even appropriate proxy metrics. But we did take them into consideration in sort of a more qualitative way. So. We applied this lens to a set of technology scenarios to try and see which scenarios stood out as I said, able to meet energy security goals and climate change mitigation goals together. For this analysis, we relied on pre-publication versions of modeling results from a set of scenarios developed by PNNL's Joint Global Change Research Institute using the Minicam model. And these models and scenarios are also used by DOE's Climate Change Technology Program. So I don't see the rest of the team here, but we'd like to thank Graham, Leon, and Bob for providing this analysis and for helping us interpret it throughout the process. Some important things to note: the parameters for this analysis, we did only look at scenarios with a 450 parts per million CO2 constraint. so that we were evaluating only mitigation scenarios and comparing those. These scenarios all involve or assume a certain level of global participation in mitigation, which is another important assumption. And finally, although the model looks out to 2100, we looked at results in 2035. From a technology deployment standpoint, this is obviously a fairly short time horizon, as it generally will take longer for major technology changes to happen and for infrastructure changes to take place. We didn't assess the latter half of the scenario results, where many of these bigger changes happen, though, as energy security concerns tend to be based on more near-term dynamics, and anything beyond 2035 we deemed to be too far into the future to truly evaluate energy security. So as you see on this table on the slide, each scenario, some technologies are considered to have achieved advanced deployment. Decreased cost and increased performance is sort of how those are put into the model relative to business as usual progress. And then others are set at reference scenario reflecting business as usual progress. And so each of these rows is a different scenario that we evaluated. The first thing to note in applying the lens, so the first and key lesson, is that business as usual, or the scenario that has no mitigation, is not a desirable outcome from obviously a mitigation standpoint, but it's also not desirable from an energy security perspective. It raises many of the same energy security concerns that we deal with today, but on a much larger scale. So that was sort of our first important conclusion. And then for the rest of the analysis, we compared the technology, the mitigation scenarios to each other. So we didn't address the non-mitigation business as usual scenario any further. But what we did was using a methodology based on standard deviation to distinguish where the scenarios and how they compared to each other and which ones sort of stood out as beneficial to both, or from a climate, I'm sorry, from an energy security perspective. So this table here summarizes the performance of the technology scenarios relative to each other. The green boxes indicate scenarios that perform better from an energy security perspective for that factor relative to all of the others. The scenarios that get red light in the category are where they fared worse relative to other scenarios. And yellow is sort of about average with the rest of them. And you'll see the non-quantifiable metrics that we talked about before we left off of this analysis. You'll hear more about the specific technologies on this next panel. So I just wanted to go through some of the lessons here relatively quickly. On the constrained reference case, you'll see a lot of red there. That just indicates that achieving mitigation without advanced technologies is going to yield undesirable energy security consequences. On the next two lines, though, you see a lot more green. Low-cost energy efficiency technologies and renewable energy technologies can help us achieve climate mitigation while generally improving energy security. The CCS line is sort of a mixed bag, but the single technology advancement on CCS provides significant cost improvements over the reference case scenario, but it also can increase vulnerability to supply security, security of supply issues, as you see it increases total energy demand. For nuclear, interestingly, the availability of advanced nuclear, but not CCS, actually yields a power sector mix that's much like the constrained reference case scenario, the first line. Even with biomass, you don't see a whole lot of significant changes to the energy mix. But finally, these last two, or the very last one, indicates that when you have all advanced technologies, it facilitates managing energy security while meeting your climate constraint. And that is one of the important points here Advanced technologies, particularly energy efficiency and renewable energies, can help us achieve cheaper, easier, more secure climate mitigation. Clearly, a 450 parts per million climate goal can be achieved with today's technologies, but it's not ideal from an energy security perspective. Looking across the scenarios, as I said, the energy efficiency technologies and the renewable technologies are clearly critically important. Another key point, though, is that some energy insecurities will remain. They're different in different scenarios depending on which technologies you're relying on, but regardless, there will be energy insecurities that we will have to manage. For instance, none of these scenarios significantly reduces our reliance on oil for transport, which is a key political concern that we may want to address separately. But then also for energy efficiency and renewables, there may be more reliability concerns unless we are able to address weaknesses in our transmission and distribution infrastructure system. Thirdly, these scenarios, as I said, are all rely on global cooperation. Additional runs on the model that we are not presenting here and actually don't really cover much in the brief, but they illustrate delayed or constrained action by at least one or other key economies outside of the U.S. These demonstrate that a lack of global coordination actually drive up the cost of mitigation significantly, and even under certain scenarios actually make it impossible to achieve the stabilization goals. I think this illustrates the importance of international cooperation, particularly cooperation on international energy technology, which maybe Rick can speak to a little bit. And finally, our final point, feasibility and particularly cost, really seem to be at the heart of the tension between energy security and climate change. All of these scenarios look daunting because the scale is just is massive. But since business as usual is not feasible either, it raises the point that maybe we need to rethink what is feasible and what we can and cannot achieve in future. And with that, I will turn it over to Rick.
Thank you, Britt. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to start by thanking CSIS and WRI for this report, for the opportunity to speak with you today, and for the leadership that both organizations have shown for a long time in trying to find a way forward on some of the more challenging issues that we face in the energy sector and beyond. And I think that this report is a useful contribution, clearly underscoring the connections across some of the key issues and challenges that we face, in particular energy security, and environmental security. And I would add to that, in some sense, economic security, because as we move forward, for example, to reduce dependence on foreign oil, that certainly helps on all three of those dimensions. And so I'll try to be brief and leave plenty of time for discussion, but I do want to hit on three key themes which I think are consonant with the main conclusions of this report. And that is, first, that technology is at the center of this, and we do need to have a sustained and clear policy framework in order to both develop and deploy technologies over a period of decades that will help us to address all these challenges. And this is not, of course, a short-term challenge. This is something that requires durable institutions, which will thereby enable the private sector to respond rationally and scale up solutions in a low-cost manner. And with that, by the way, comes U.S. leadership internationally on the technology front, which is also important. Finally, I'd like to make clear that we are down this path. The American Reinvestment and Recovery Act gives us an excellent kickstart to the process of transforming both domestically and internationally to a clean energy and more secure energy economy. The legislation currently working its way through Congress, notably passing the House just recently, as well as international discussions, are all headed in the direction of that durable policy framework that will enable us to tackle all these challenges in a rational and low-cost fashion. So a bit of detail to underlie and I think reinforce largely what this report addresses. First, with strong near-term deployment-oriented policies, existing technologies can get us down the path to our greenhouse gas abatement goals, and that will involve, as you can see on this graph. Well, let me just explain what's here. This draws on a DOE effort with McKinsey and Company, updating some and nuancing some of the earlier work by McKinsey in this area. And basically, what it shows is that through 2030, which is the scope of this particular forthcoming analysis, there are options in the building sector, the transportation sector, and so on, which will allow us to be on a path consistent with the administration's long-term goal of at least 80% reductions in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. And I think you can see then that this does involve the entire economy. It involves the entire energy economy. Also, notably, it involves the agricultural waste and forestry sectors as well. And so this is an all-hands-on-deck and complex and sustained effort that's required involving everyone. But it is achievable. Now this, first a show of hands, how many people in the room have seen a version of this cost curve? Yeah, it's something I was involved with in a prior role at McKinsey, and so I'm happy to come back to it and talk about it a little bit, but I won't belabor the point since many of you are familiar with it. I think the essence of this is to say that it's going to be a detailed, multifactorial solution set in order to address this problem in a comprehensive way. But you can group things into a few big categories, and that's what you see in the pie chart in the bottom. Basically, you've got the renewable energy and energy efficiency dimensions, as well as transportation, playing a huge role, and all of those solutions help us with our energy security challenge at the same time that they help us address global warming. So you look at fuel economy, a clear win on both dimensions. You look at other kinds of efficiency which help to attenuate natural gas demand, also helpful in terms of economic and national security. And, of course, renewable power is part of the mix as well. But the other message that you may not have come across in reference to these analyses is that with the energy efficiency comes a lot of opportunity for cost-effective solutions. And so it's critical that we deploy existing energy efficiency technologies aggressively through a whole range of policies that can help to make that happen. And we'll talk about that a little bit later as well. And this chart basically shows what this represents is if you look at the trace of this cost curve, and for those who haven't seen it before, what this is billion tons of emissions taken out of the economy in 2030 and the cost per ton of those abatement opportunities. And what this adds up to then is what you see here, the 4.3 billion tons of abatement needed in the 2030 time range to be roughly on path to the 80% reductions by mid-century. And then the next slide I'm going to show you is just the trace of this cost curve without all the detail. And this is the high-range case that this analysis identifies. What are the low-range and mid-range cases? Well, that's basically where we don't have clear, sustained, rapid policy implementation in order to begin down this path. And if we don't have leadership on the policy, there's very little chance that we will be in the position we need to be in the year 2030 and beyond to address this challenge. In fact, we'll get caught short in terms of the opportunity set that we have in future periods. And that's for a number of reasons. One reason is that without the policy framework, certain time-sensitive opportunities disappear. If you don't have the right building codes in place, you don't build the right buildings, and then it's too late. Same thing for vehicles. And there I would like to highlight the recent progress by the administration on CAFE standards, which is pushing us very much in the right direction on fuel economy and represents major progress in unlocking some of that potential you saw on the prior charts. But we need comprehensive action that addresses all the sectors in order to provide that policy leadership and make sure we end up on something that looks more like the gray line in the high-range case where we need to be, and less like the caught-short part of this graph. That's true, by the way, both domestically and internationally. And then let me just highlight in the longer term the importance of research and development investment. So in addition to deploying energy efficiency technologies and other available clean supply technologies through clear policies today, of course, we need to pay attention to the long-term research and development aspect of this challenge. And this is simply an illustrative analysis done by the Department of Energy that shows in one set of scenarios the sort of radical difference in long-term through 2100 costs of achieving greenhouse gas abatement goals depending upon whether or not you do reach advanced technology goals. The key driver of whether or not we reach advanced technology goals is, do we have a rational and sustained R&D policy in order to help the private sector get us there? Second key driver, by the way, is all that deployment policy framework. If you have the right cap and trade bill and if you have the right associated policies in place, that helps industry to respond rationally to scale up its own investment in R&D and demonstration to get these technologies into the marketplace. In any event, it's a crucial part of the global challenge to make sure that all that is aligned and that we, in fact, get the full suite of technologies developed and deployed over these very long timescales. This is the most slow-moving and arguably most complex sector of the economy. If you want to lay out a spectrum, semiconductors are probably on the other end of the spectrum in terms of the pace of change and the level of specificity that you can get to in terms of a particular chip solving the problem. What you need in the energy sector is much more integrated, much more long-term, very low turnover rates for capital stock. And that's why it's so important to take a gradual, sustained approach with clear policies guiding you along the way. So let's talk a little bit about where we are with this policy challenge. The American Reinvestment and Recovery Act passed earlier this year. I know this is hard to read, but I just wanted to give you a sense that there is a massive commitment already made, a down payment in place with the recovery bill towards clean energy. And that includes both R&D in the form of things like the energy equivalent of DARPA, as well as deployment efforts in the form of things like the weatherization assistant grants to the tune of $5 billion, immediately deploying existing technologies in order to provide energy efficiency cost savings. And there's a whole suite of things here. And one of the challenges is to build on this down payment towards a sustained legacy of successful policies to address all these challenges. Just briefly, one of the examples of the impacts of policy on the private sector investment trends, quick analysis by National Renewable Energy Lab suggesting that wind deployment has been lagging due to the financial crisis going from the green to the purple, but with the stimulus bill back up to the blue. Now, you'll note that there's still a leveling off after 2012. That's when the production tax credits will be expiring. And so, again, a need for sustained, clear policy frameworks so that the industry can continue to scale rationally. And that's where, for example, climate legislation can come in and make a difference. Just in closing, I want to underscore that the president is deeply committed to pushing this entire clean energy economy forward. And the Hill is, of course, moving forward with climate legislation that helps us in that direction and provides both the price signal as well as strong energy bill components to the climate legislation, things like renewable electricity standard and strong building codes, et cetera. And then lastly, a quick word on the international context. There is a clear linkage here, by the way, and I think everyone in this room is probably well aware of that. In order for us to make progress in the multilateral discussions leading up to Copenhagen and in Copenhagen itself, we need the kind of sustained progress that we are seeing on the Hill as well to show the leadership at home that allows us to lead abroad. And so this all links together. And in Copenhagen, we are pushing for a global solution to what is ultimately a global challenge, and that does require all of the economies of the world to be a part of the answer here. So happy to talk about all this further in the Q&A. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes for Q&A, and we'll have microphones in the back of the room. We have a couple ground rules for those of you who don't come here regularly. Please state your name and affiliation, and if you can please put the question in the form of a question, we'd really appreciate it. So let's see. We'll start over there with Shirley.
My name is Shirley Neff, and I'm a senior associate here at CSIS. Yesterday, DOE and the Treasury Department announced the plans to allow grants instead of tax credits for renewable energy projects. I think that's great. I'm working on a condo project right now, and we can't take advantage of the tax credit. My question to you is there any thought within the administration about extending the commercial tax incentives to condos and co-ops and other buildings that aren't eligible for tax incentives? I mean, they're a big part of the urban residential load.
I'm going to plead the...
Press your button, yeah.
Okay, can you hear me now? I'm going to plead the 2 weeks into the job excuse on this one. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that. Happy to speak afterwards and perhaps can get you an answer. But right now, I don't know.
That's fair.
Gweta Mazzetti, I was a Clinton appointee doing energy at DOD. And I also I'm on contract to the Chief of Staff of the Army, and I'm at the Defense Science Board. I do energy security and renewable energy and energy efficiency. Part of the problem that the federal government rank and file has is sorting through the technologies to meet the criteria that you're talking about. And a lot of times people coming through the door that make claims and there's no place to check it. During the 1970s, the Office of Technology Assessment was set up by Congress. Newt Gingrich and Bob Walker did away with that, and I know they're talking about bringing that back. But is there going to be some methodology and set criteria in the Department of Energy, a place to go that makes an independent assessment of what's going to meet the climate criteria and what isn't?
Excellent question, and I would suggest that the short answer is yes. And the exact form that that takes is, of course, still evolving at this relatively early stage in the Department of Energy's evolution under the new administration. I'm personally committed to exactly that challenge. There are many others in the leadership at DOE who are also committed to it. And again, happy to talk further about it offline and open to suggestions as to how we best achieve that kind of strategic approach. Clearly, public resources are always scarce. I know that in some ways a billion seems to be the new million these days, but in some regards that's a temporary condition, and we have to be very strategic in how we pursue our R&D investments as well as early stage demonstration, and of course have to take care with what we do on the deployment policy front as well. And all that requires exactly the kind of strategic lens that you're suggesting, and we're committed to it.
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
This question's for Rick.
Okay, can you identify yourself?
I'm Rory Marston. I'm from ITT Space Systems. You're probably wondering, what's a space guy doing at an energy thing? Well, I used to work in the Senate on the Commerce Committee, and we looked at climate change issues. I've read the ACES bill, all 1,400 pages. It's a killer. My question is the Department of Energy going to work with President Obama's new offices he's set up in NOAA to actually measure the successes versus doing the mathematical or arithmetic methods? The ACES bill really doesn't address it.
I'm sorry. Can you give a little more clarity as to what you're driving at there? I didn't quite follow the question.
I'm sorry. We need to be able to measure the successes of your programs.
Mm-hmm.
You're cutting things down, but right now what we're doing, the system that's set up, because it's the best we've got, is you say, okay, you've burned this much fossil fuel, you do a mathematic calculation, and you say, this is how much you've emitted.
Mm.
And so you do your calculations to figure it out. But we're not really, the bill doesn't really address measuring it scientifically to say, yes, there is a cause and effect. I was wondering if you are working with NOAA.
Well, I'll say this, and it's probably not precisely what you're looking for, but there's certainly an active interagency effort to address this whole challenge. It requires involvement of all the agencies in order to get this right and get this work done, and that includes NOAA and DOE discussions. I think, in general, we will need sustained commitment to monitoring and verification of the whole implementation process, and that includes the energy sector as well as whatever is done in terms of non-energy sectors as well.
And a plug for CSIS. We're actually doing a climate knowledge project with the conjunction between the energy program here and the space program here and the technology program here to look at questions of Earth observation and sort of the feedback assessment part of exactly sort of what you're talking about. So it's a great question. Okay, I think we got time for one more question. Tina.
Hi, I'm Tina Karsberg. I'm with DOE, and I had a question for Britt. Actually, for both of you, if you want to answer it. I noticed there seemed to be one aspect of reliability and renewables that I think about a lot, which is sort of the centralized versus distributed. And that has to do with infrastructure, and that also relates to things like nuclear. And I was wondering if you could comment on how considering that really explicitly might have affected, you know, your results, or would it have just been sort of the same, you know, greens and reds? And so, in other words, you know, what is the vulnerability of a centralized versus distributed system, and how that plays out in energy?
I think that's a really good question. Particularly, I mean, we've just completed a research report on concentrating solar thermal, which is a particularly centralized form of renewable energy. And I had a couple of copies outside, but if anybody's interested, I can email PDFs. But anyway, to your specific question, we did evaluate that qualitatively. In the data that we were using, there wasn't a specific breakdown of the kinds of renewables, and you know whether this scenario presented a centralized or a decentralized approach to renewable technologies. So we weren't able to quantitatively assess that, and that's really what you saw in the red and green and yellow table. But we did take that kind of factor into consideration more qualitatively in our assessment. But sort of I think personally, I see a combination approach to deploying the renewable and energy efficiency technologies with both centralized and decentralized resources being used that would both achieve climate mitigation and address some of these security implications as well. So,
yeah, I think, Tina, further, one of the ways it came up in our conversations was, of course, when you talk about the grid and sort of the ability for the grid to be more advanced so that you can have distributed generation sources that sort of feed back into the grid, or you could just have distributed generation. So there was a discussion about how either redundancies like that or having the ability to have off-grid sources was particularly helpful from a security standpoint. There was also sort of a commercial standpoint, though. You know, if you have such wide-scale sort of distributed generation sources, what does that do to the commercial viability of some of these more centralized systems, some of these projects going forward? So we had a couple interesting discussions, but we're limited, as Britt said, in a couple of ways in terms of how we were able to analyze them based on sort of the data that we had. So we have time for one more short question. If anyone's got one, right there.
I'm Ruth Smith with Alstom. My question's very short. I don't know how short the answer will be. I just wondered if you can give us a quick preview of the Secretary's trip to China next week.
I can give you a quick preview. The Secretary's trip to China next week is going to involve a whole range of topics, as you might imagine. I think we are in a very productive dialogue there broadly in the Major Economies Forum, as well as bilaterally, all in the context of leading up to the multilateral challenge in Copenhagen in December. And
there is, I think, tremendous value in continuing to build that dialogue, build that relationship, and this is another step in that process. The exact outcomes can't be predicted at this point.
That's a good answer. Well, I just wanted to say thank you both to Britt from WRI, who we've really enjoyed working with over the last couple of years. It's really been a pleasure. And also, in this project in particular, working with the Climate Change Technology Program and the folks that Rick is now working with over at DOE was really wonderful. They have a lot to do. They don't need to take time out of their day to play with think tanks, but they did, and it was really helpful. And also, thanks to Rick. It's a brave thing to be in office for a few short weeks and come out and take questions publicly, so we do appreciate that. We're going to bring the next panel up, but before we do that, I'd like you to please join me in thanking Britt and Rick. Okay, so we're really, by the way, my name is Sarah Ladislaw. I'm a fellow here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we're really glad to have all of you here today. We're sorry about sort of the tight quarters. You never know how many people show up on a beautiful Friday afternoon in the middle of the summer. So for those of you who are kind of still standing, we just cleared the audience of our panel at the very least. So please take their seats. And what we wanted to do, really, you know, glad that Britt was able to do an overview of the paper, but we did this, you know, recognizing that energy models and climate models can only be so precise, and really there is sort of another commercial perspective out there and a technology perspective. We wanted to allow some of the representatives from industry and technology groups to sort of respond to some of the things that we've put forward in the brief, but also to be able to talk about how their view of their particular industry or technology contributes to energy security and climate change goals, but also what they see when they look going forward. Rick Duke talked a lot about having these, you know, strong policy frameworks that are consistent over a significant enough period of time. Do they see those things emerging? How is the current economic condition affecting their business and their technology outlook going forward? So that's what the purpose of this panel is. And I'd like to just quickly sort of introduce some of the panelists that we've invited today. First, we've got Rob Church from the American Council on Renewable Energy, and he's going to be talking about sort of the renewables perspective. We also have Paul Genoa from the Nuclear Energy Institute, who's going to talk a little bit about the nuclear perspective. Then we've got Joe Loper, who many of you might have seen here a couple times before. You've been here a couple times, from the Alliance to Save Energy, who's going to talk about energy efficiency. And then finally, Sarah Forbes from the World Resources Institute, who is very helpful in sort of helping us think through some of the carbon capture and sequestration dimensions of the study we presented. So I'm going to stop talking now and invite up first, I believe we'll have Paul Genoa. You don't have any slides, so feel free to speak from there or hear whichever you prefer.
Well, thank you, Sarah. I would first like to just thank the sponsors of this report and the hosts for this event, the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the World Resources Institute, for the invitation to be here and share our perspectives with you today. The Nuclear Energy Institute is the Washington-based policy organization for the commercial nuclear industry. Our focus is to foster the beneficial uses of nuclear technologies worldwide. The Institute's members include companies that operate commercial nuclear power plants, their suppliers and labor unions, as well as leading universities, radiopharmaceutical and radioisotope manufacturing facilities, and others. As NEI's Director of Policy Development, my focus is nuclear energy's current and future role and contribution in sustainable development. I believe that nuclear energy plays an increasing role at the critical intersection of energy security, environmental security, and economic development. I'd like to begin my remarks with a recognition of the importance of this emerging collaboration between CSIS and WRI. Both this report and its companion, the Roadmap for a Secure Low-Carbon Energy Economy, are important steps towards a more holistic approach to policymaking. Today, in my opinion, we're hampered by a legacy of stovepipe thinking, perpetuated by the very process of structuring our federal agencies and national laboratories. And frankly, this is compounded by the jurisdictional blinders that limit the focus of congressional committees who set policy and who fund those agencies and those laboratories. By nature, these structures limit policy development. Environmental policies often avoid the distraction, frankly, of potential economic and energy security ramifications. So, too, energy security and economic development initiatives may discount potential environmental impacts. These structural limitations are often reinforced by the advocacy of special interest groups who focus, by nature, on just one of these key objectives. Both of these reports resulting from this collaboration work to break down these barriers by providing tools and perspectives that policymakers can use to begin crafting policies designed to optimize three critical objectives: protecting our environment, securing our energy, and sustainable economic development. Now, turning to the nuclear-specific findings of the report, I am reassured that nuclear power production increases substantially in all evaluated scenarios. This confirms what we have seen in all credible studies that attempt to predict future energy mixes in a carbon-constrained world. The study also finds the most affordable scenario is one in which aggressive technology improvements occur across the board, including renewables, energy efficiency, carbon capture and storage, and nuclear power, what is called the all-advanced scenario. This also confirms what we believe based on a variety of credible studies, including the EPRI PRISM analysis, and I see some of my EPRI friends here today. Increasingly, the report finds that all of the scenarios raise serious concerns about the feasibility of aggressively deploying advanced technologies other than coal and nuclear. And I'll return to the feasibility issue momentarily. The report goes on to highlight that feasibility and cost issues are at the heart of the tension between the energy security and the climate change community. And the very fact that nuclear power production increases in all scenarios helps to underscore the growing recognition by both of these communities that nuclear energy will play an increasingly vital role going forward. Now, thinking about next steps and potential future opportunities for collaboration, I'd like to recommend additional work on the factors used to create the energy security lens. I think what was laid out in this report is a very good start, but I believe more work could be done. I think it's important that to more clearly identify the relative weighting factors that would be used to evaluate technology deployment policies. For instance, the weighting factor associated with feasibility of actually deploying a technology must be important and should be evaluated. Another example would be the electrification of the transport sector. I think perhaps a more robust analysis in that area would be useful because it is not just our light vehicles and trucks and battery technology, but rather the electrification of transport across the board. And there are many opportunities from light rail and you name it. So I think some work could be done in that area. And that may shift some of the factors in the later analysis, because as we electrify the transport sector, new opportunities and benefits for energy security will emerge. But to get back to the nuclear issue, for instance, it is described, that factor, as nuclear proliferation, for instance, is described as a traditional security risk, and it's used as a surrogate for energy security. And the simple metric is if you increase nuclear power, you increase the risk, and therefore you decrease your energy security. This is hardly a robust analysis. It perpetuates the myth that increasing the use of nuclear energy in the United States increases the risk of proliferation. There is simply no evidence to support this position. We are a weapons state with thousands of warheads and surplus nuclear materials. A substantial increase in nuclear power in the United States is not going to significantly increase the proliferation risk here. In fact, U.S. reactors are actually reducing the proliferation risk worldwide by consuming former weapons material. Today, 50% of the fuel used by the 104 nuclear power plants in the United States comes from downblending former Russian warhead material. That means that 1 out of 10 American homes and businesses get all their electricity from former Soviet weapons that were once pointed at them. This is an important thing to think about. Consuming this material in a reactor is really the only and the best way to get rid of it. A second myth is also perpetuated, the idea that if the U.S. turns away from nuclear power, the proliferation risk will be reduced. This is also a false assumption. Today, there are 47 nuclear power plants under construction around the world, 133 planned or on order, and an additional 282 proposed. Of these, only 32 are in the United States. Clearly, the world has made a decision to move forward on nuclear power, regardless of whether the U.S. follows. The real question is, will the world be a safer place with the U.S. as a full partner in this deployment? Our technology, our regulation, our safeguards, our quality assurance, and our operational experience are second to none worldwide. We are the gold standard. I firmly believe that U.S. nuclear leadership makes the world a safer place. The simple fact is that nuclear energy does not reduce energy security. It improves it. Both France and Japan are clear examples of energy resource poor countries that made a clear decision to go forward with nuclear to improve their energy security situation. More recently, Finland and the United Kingdom have explicitly embraced nuclear energy for its energy security benefits, in large part to avoid the insecurity of Russian natural gas. I think a March 2009 quote from Prime Minister Gordon Brown sums it up nicely. And I quote, "So however we look at it, we will not secure the supply of sustainable energy on which the future of the planet depends without a role for civil nuclear power." In closing, it is not just the Nuclear Energy Institute and its members who share the view that nuclear energy provides important energy security and environmental benefits. In May of 2009, the G8 energy ministers came together in Italy, and their joint statement following that meeting, and I quote, "We note that, in the opinion of a growing number of countries, the use of nuclear power can diversify the energy mix, contribute to energy security while reducing greenhouse gas emissions." And just this week in Italy, at the G8 Leaders Summit, the leaders, including President Obama, declared that, and I quote, "In the opinion of these countries, nuclear energy can play an essential role as it meets the dual challenge of reducing greenhouse emissions and lowering fossil fuel consumption." Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was excellent. Okay, and next we're going to bring up Rob Church from ACOR to talk about the renewables perspective.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a difficult group to talk to because I think many of you know probably as much as I can tell you in 10 minutes about renewable energy, so there'll be relatively little new to tell. But let me just give you a perspective, and I like the idea of the CSIS lens. As a next consultant, I can't take anything without playing with it a little bit, so I've played with it a little bit and maybe have a perspective of a renewable energy version of the lens. And I think there's a lot of overlap here, but some of the things like proliferation don't really apply to us. But when I think of security, I think of the components of security. I think of physical security, price security, economic stability. And I think economic stability, when I first put it on there, seemed like not quite a security issue. But I think in some of the cases, if we look at some of the potential futures for climate change, and the disruption that that would have across the world, it's hard to think that you can have a secure world if it's a world where there's a lot going on and there's a lot of stress elsewhere caused by climate change. I think that's going to filter into an energy security question. environmental sustainability, and I think that links back to the economic stability, and then social acceptability. I think all of us have seen that, that some forms of energy can't be, you can't judge them necessarily with a green eye shade, even with things that seem as benign as renewable wind. If you try to put them in off of Cape Cod, you may have some small amount of trouble. When just for common terminology, when I talk about renewable energy, I'm really talking about principally five sources: solar, wind, hydro, geothermal, biomass. To some extent, we also consider waste energy a renewable when we look at it. You can either include it or not. And then the uses are electricity, transportation, fuel, and thermal. I think one of the really important components of looking at energy is to look at the electricity market and the transportation fuel market separately, but recognize that there are really some forces going on to link them. I've been in this business now for 30 years, and one of the truisms was that those were completely different markets and they don't overlap. But now as we see compressed natural gas being used more and more in transportation, and particularly as we see things like plug-in hybrid electric vehicles coming along, I think you can see these two markets beginning to link, and I think there are some very important implications for that. And then the final market is thermal, space heating, and things like that. I just put, whoops, we didn't get the, unfortunate, I had a row of very interesting check marks. We probably don't have the same set of fonts that I do, but let me run through here. With renewable electricity, that's wind, solar, hydro, geothermal, and biomass, I think it's almost impossible to find a place where they don't help in some respect. They certainly help us with physical supply security, although on the electrical sector, we really don't import much of our fuel, so there's not a whole lot of physical supply security there associated with it. In a price security, it's going to help because it's a capital-intensive resource that has essentially zero variable fuel cost in most cases. So your price security, once you get it built, you have a great deal of understanding what your future cost of operation is going to be. We think it helps economic stability, and frankly, I'm going to tell you that a lot of our analysis suggests that some of the widespread analysis that's been done historically of rolling out renewable energy and looking at the economic impact of that has just got it wrong. We just completed a study for the state of Kansas of looking at a very aggressive rollout of renewable energy in Kansas and rolled it on through to the economic impact on Kansas. And while you can show in many cases rolling out renewable energy is going to raise the nominal price of electricity, the economic impact of a domestic renewable energy industry in the United States has really dramatic impacts, or can have dramatic impacts on the economy. It can be another it probably won't be another PC business, but it can be a lot bigger than it is today. And it's a business that it's ours to either capture or lose. Right now, most of the wind turbines in the United States come from Europe, and increasingly they're going to be coming from Japan. But we're getting some manufacturing plants there. To a large extent, we don't own the photovoltaic production market in the United States, but we could. So there's some things that we could do in terms of economic stability where the renewable energy rollout could add more to the economy in terms of GDP and jobs going forward. Environmental sustainability, obviously renewables score well there. And social acceptability, I gave it a check minus because I think it's important to recognize that any broad-scale, large energy infrastructure has social acceptability issues, and it's really naive of the renewable energy industry to think that if you're going to come in and put in something that we think is environmentally acceptable, that it will be necessarily socially acceptable. And I think in many cases going forward, the industry, especially on the electric side with large-scale things like wind turbines, is going to have to make sure that what they do is acceptable to local communities. On a transportation side, it's kind of you get a much more spotty delivery. You obviously get the physical supply security, because when we're talking about renewable energy in the United States as transportation fuel today, that's a domestic product. So we're not dependent upon foreign imports. I don't know that you get any more price security out of that. I think when you start looking at the price of renewable fuels in the transportation sector, I think they're necessarily tied to the world supply of oil and the world price of oil. So I think that you don't get a whole lot there, but you do pick up physical supply security. Economic stability, it doesn't seem that we are getting much of that, at least in the current ethanol industry. It seems to be a boom and bust industry, so I think there might be some policy issues there to iron out. And environmental sustainability also, with the current technology of ethanol, is at least in question and being challenged at some levels. And then finally, social acceptability. It seems that goes both ways, but it seems like there's a good bit of acceptance to ethanol as a fuel blend. As we look at this, compared to the electric side, we got more positive check marks on the electric side. But if you look at energy security in a carbon-constrained world, it seems to me just personally that there's more bang for the buck on the transportation fuel side. And so from a renewable standpoint, where we're strongest, the need is less. And what I see is the technology that bridges that is the plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. The stuff we see on the plug-in hybrid electric vehicle suggests 75 to 100 miles per consumed gallon of liquid fuels is going to be very much in the ballpark of what the first generation of units are going to deliver. That's what people like Google are finding in their conversion fleets. And if we could accelerate that and push that from a policy standpoint in there, then you start shifting that consumption away from fuels that or energy sources that have supply security problems, price security problems, potentially environmental sustainability problems, to more electricity, and I think you get some real bang for the buck there. Just for completeness sake, the renewable thermal side, the solar thermal, the biomass, those all work really well. They seem to compete mostly against natural gas, and I think natural gas is increasingly becoming a world product. Now we're having enough trade in natural gas that I think the prices in those markets are going to start to converge, and potentially we're going to see some of the same price volatility in the natural gas markets that we've had in the oil markets, and so there's some real benefit to going forward on that. Let me just kind of give you the step back and the so what as we kind of see it there. Renewable energy can be a big part of the solution for what we're dealing with, both in terms of supply security, climate issues, economic growth, price stability. The resource base is vast. I recently took a quick look on the WEA website and looked at the 10 plain states from Minnesota down, over to Montana and down to Texas. There's 10 states, and the wind resource in that area would provide, just on a pure energy basis, 2/3 of our current electrical demand. Now, that doesn't match up from a timing standpoint, so you don't get 2/3, but that's 10 states with a substantial amount of electricity. That doesn't include the other states like California, the coastal states. It doesn't include the other renewable energy components, but renewable energy is a big resource if we can find a way to tap it and deliver it. But it's not a panacea. It's going to take work. Some of the technology is not yet mature. Fortunately, on the electric side, we seem to be moving in the right direction and very, very close on both wind and things like solar and geothermal to having technologies that are, in fact, economically competitive. On the fuel side, I think we have that classic case where we need 100,000 biologists working in 10,000 labs all trying to find just the right algae, so we'll end up with an algae that we can get fuel from. Costs are declining as scale is achieved. Even in the current ethanol industry, they're making some impressive gains. I think one of the key points that we see going forward is that commercial success in this is a private sector, not a government program. For the last 30 years, we've looked at renewable energy essentially as being a government program where DOE takes the lead. And I think if it's going to succeed as an industry, it's a private sector initiative, and it's time to get out of the DOE help mode and into the we're going to do it on our own, but to work with DOE. DOE has a big role to play, but they're not going to make it a success. There's not nearly the amount of money to come out of the government to make this industry achieve what it can achieve, but a stable government policy is essential. We've seen the on-again, off-again PTC, ITC, and what that's done to the wind industry. What we really need is a government policy that hangs around for some years. I'm old enough, as some of you others are, to have been – this is my second time around on an energy crisis. And we under Carter, things got moving in the right direction. We started reducing our oil consumption. The prices dropped in the mid-'80s. We said, well, that problem's solved, and we dismantled all those programs. If we had left those programs in place, I don't think we'd be sitting here today talking about energy security, because I think the price of oil would still be a lot more affordable. We wouldn't be worrying about whether it was going to go back to $140 a barrel. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rob. Okay, next up we've got Joe Loper from the Alliance to Save Energy to talk about efficiency.
Thanks, Sarah. When Sarah asked me to come over here, she reminded me of the nexus between our environmental objectives, our economic objectives, and our security objectives, and reminded me that energy efficiency plays right in the middle, and that I don't need to convince you of that. So I'm just wanted to tell you that because it's Sarah being presumptuous, not me. And I'm not going to go through those arguments, but instead focus on how energy efficiency fits into the current climate legislation, which I think is which Sarah told me would be relevant. Mostly I will be talking about the Waxman-Markey legislation that just passed in the House two Fridays ago, and most of the data that I will be using is from an EPA analysis that many of you may have already seen. I've been in Washington since 1991, working on energy efficiency as an advocate, and most of the time I've kind of sat around not quite sure what I should be doing. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but since 2007, we had seminal legislation, more powerful legislation related to energy efficiency than I've seen in the nearly 20 years that I've been here. It raised a corporate average fuel economy standards for the first time since 1985. It has a significant increase in or it has a standard for to basically outlaw the incandescent light bulb. Beginning in 2012. So those are very significant policies. But it pales in comparison to what could be done under the climate legislation as it's being discussed. Having our eye on the bottom line, it would be Waxman-Markey, as it was written, is approximately a 70% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, and that's total greenhouse gas emissions for the United States by 2050. And from 2005 levels. So it's not quite 80% below 1990 levels, but it's a pretty big hit. on the energy side, energy demand would basically be flat through 2050. So it would offset all the increase in energy demand. Let me point out that the EPA analysis is based on current estimates of GDP growth, and energy demand is highly dependent on income growth. And so if they go back to the previous reference case assumptions about GDP growth, that would not this may not hold. But under current projections, the energy demand would be flat through 2050. Energy demand would be 12% below business as usual in 2050. Energy efficiency is a huge winner, but basically the biggest winner in all this is nuclear, according to the EPA analysis. And I just underscore that because I heard a lot of, listening, being really bored on two Fridays ago and listening to the House deliberations on the Waxman-Markey, I heard a lot of people saying, there's nothing for nuclear here. Well, I would argue that, in fact, there's quite a bit for nuclear. There are, in terms of, so this price signal is a big one. There's this carbon externality cost that's hanging out there, whether it's nuclear or energy efficiency or renewables. People are holding off from making investments because there's no, because there's a, not that, that price signal is not there. So basically all of these carbon abatement technologies are being underinvested. On the energy efficiency side, there are a bunch of non-price barriers, and I threw this up. I don't know if Rick Duke is still around, because I'll probably get sued or something, but this is the McKinsey curve, the old one, not the current one that they're working on with the DOE, and I've just polluted it with a bunch of information about market barriers. And so on the left side, they have the negative costs of all these measures. Why aren't people doing it if it's so cost-effective? There's a number of reasons. One is there's uncertainty about those costs. Two, there's split incentives, tenant-landlord type split. So landlords are buying the equipment, the energy-using equipment, but renters are paying the energy bills. There's lock-in. So for a long, my favorite example right now is big cars. It's kind of scary to buy a small car when you're surrounded, if you're surrounded by a bunch of big cars. And that's a form of lock-in that I don't hear talked about too much. But information barriers are a big one on energy efficiency. And to some extent, that's actually a cost. It's the same thing as when I go home on the weekend, the last thing I want to do is read through my phone bill to try to minimize my phone bill costs. Rather, I'll just go ahead and pay the extra and know that I'm probably paying too much so that I don't have to deal with the hassle. And to some extent, that's one of the barriers to energy efficiency, too. It can be a hassle. That's where things like the Energy Star program that provides information on the energy use of different appliances reduces that hassle. I can go to the store and know that I'm going to get a cost-effective, energy-efficient appliance if I go buy an Energy Star appliance. So even though you get a carbon price out of the climate legislation, you still have these other barriers that are sitting out there. In other words, people are not paying attention to that price. And so what do you do about it? And that's where, from the energy efficiency community's perspective, we're pushing complementary energy efficiency policies and programs to help overcome those barriers. If those barriers are not addressed, you have an underinvestment in energy efficiency, and it increases the overall cost of abatement to the extent that you're not doing energy efficiency measures that were cost-effective. So it's also putting a greater burden on other sectors. And so if, for example, end-use customers are not buying energy-efficient, cost-effective energy-efficient appliances, then you've got to go get the savings from fuel switching or from other areas of the economy that are presumably more expensive. Energy efficiency programs and policies in the Waxman-Markey legislation, as a result of those programs and policies, get you 2% lower allowance prices and get you 4-6% lower electric and gas demand. That's just from the policies and programs, and that's in addition to the price signal driven energy efficiency. On the funding side for programs, Waxman-Markey would have 3-6% of total allowance value going to energy efficiency programs. That's anywhere from $85 to $174 billion over the 2012 to 2050 period. So quite a bit of cash. You can see this is kind of the curve that it goes on, and I can give you more details if you want afterwards. But I just want to put it in perspective, though, because it looks like a lot of cash, and it is a lot of cash. But last year, the spending by the federal government, state governments, and utilities was about $4 billion. And if you look at the curve here, you may get up to $4 billion, may get up to $6 billion for a few years, but in general, it's very much in league with current spending. Now, if you add this spending on top of additional spending, it's a doubling of spending. If it was $4 billion plus $4 billion, if it's displacing existing spending, which we all know could very well be the case, then it's really not a very big increase. And so, or any increase perhaps at all. And so I don't know whether to tell you it's too much or too little at this point. I will say probably more is better from my perspective, at least. But that's, the most important thing is the cap and the price. Also, to put it in perspective, the stimulus bill basically gave about $16 billion to energy efficiency over 2 years, which was a doubling overall as a doubling of energy efficiency spending and then a tripling in the following year. Some programs, the state energy programs, for example, it was a 35-fold increase in spending. And so you're talking some major ramp up in terms of capacity and the ability to deploy this funding effectively. I will just skip over. This is just allowance allocations by program, so you can see over the total 38 years, the energy efficiency is that sliver of the pie. And so this slide, which there actually was gray lettering below this, of all the other energy it's kind of held over there, yeah. So there's of the other energy efficiency policies, but I'm just going to focus on and programs, but I'm just going to focus on the two that are dark here, and that is building code provisions. And these are the building code provision, probably in terms of the complementary policies in the Waxman-Markey, is probably the one that we're most attached to and will most adamantly defend in the Senate as we move forward. The efficiency and renewable standard, which would require utilities to achieve so much energy savings through demand-side management programs, is something that we're very supportive of. But in both the House and the Senate versions, it's not powerful enough to really matter to us much. Building energy codes development. I listed all those market barriers up there. And I think it's very important when you go get a carbon price to think about what kind of barriers that you're trying to address, because some policies address some barriers very well. Some policies don't really address a particular barrier very well. In the case of building energy codes, it addresses many of those barriers very well, including the split incentives, information barriers, first cost, and the lock-in barriers. The problem with building codes is they're slow because you only have right now, I think, 1.5 million homes a year or something. Normally it's higher than that. But so you have a slow turnover and ability to capture that those savings or get the efficiency into new buildings. But the savings are very long-lasting once you do. They can last 50 or 100 or more years. The targets in the legislation, without going into too much detail, would basically go 30% beyond current model energy codes in 2020 and 50% beyond in 2030, which is fairly aggressive, but by our standards is well within the range of doable. It would also, and this is a very controversial provision in the legislation, it would provide a federal backstop. And so if the typical codes councils who create these model codes and the states don't adopt, there would be a federal backstop, which would, in some way, it's not a national energy code, but it would put pressure on state and local governments who are the ones who administer building codes. It would put pressure on them to develop and adopt aggressive ones. And there's also money for compliance with the codes, which is a huge issue on the code front. On the efficiency and renewable electric standards, typically we're talking about 15% of demand being met through energy efficiency in 2021, 2020, that range. Part of the problem with this is that you're already on the energy efficiency side, certainly, you're already going to get most of that even if you don't do the standard, and so it doesn't really mean much to us. In fact, business as usual energy efficiency across the United States, given the policies that are already out there and the activities that utilities are already undertaking, is likely to reach 5%. You can see on the Senate side that they would require 4%, and on the House side, 5% and possibly up to 8%. The impact on electric demand overall of these policies and programs, these complementary policies and programs, about more than one-third of the 2030 demand reduction from more than one-third of the total demand reduction that's coming out of the overall bill could come from energy efficiency policies and programs. That's in one-third in addition to the price-driven energy efficiency reductions. It gets much smaller in 2050 because a lot of those programs die out over time. Let me just hit on two. Am I okay? Two more minutes. Let me just hit on two issues that we have with the legislation related that will affect energy efficiency and investments in energy efficiency. One is the electric utility allowance allocation. About one-third goes out to electric utilities. We don't necessarily have a problem with that per se. That's a negotiation that goes on in a room that is far away from my room. And it's probably very dark and smoky in there, and I don't want to be in that room. So one-third of allowances are going to electric utilities. Currently, there is language in the legislation that tries to ensure that the utilities don't just rebate all their customers on the basis of their carbon emissions. So a utility has a carbon price. The customer is paying a higher electric bill as a result, and the legislation seems to try to keep the utility from just handing that same amount of money back to each customer. Okay? The reason for that is that would mute the carbon price. And so the end user, the customers of the electric utilities, would never see a carbon price and therefore would not have any incentive to go invest on the demand side in energy efficiency. We kind of thought when we actually did an analysis a month ago or so, and kind of thought that this was dealt with in the legislation, but it's becoming more worrisome to us in that it looks like a lot of the utilities that are going, especially some of the coal-burning utilities that are receiving these free allowances, are just going to surrender those allowances back to the government. It's not exactly working that way, but it's something like that. And so what that would do is perfectly mute the carbon price to the end-use customers. They would have no carbon price signal in terms of electric customers and therefore have no incentive to do anything. So that's something that we're trying to work with people to fix. Offsets. I'm sure a lot of people in the room, if you're paying attention to this, are more conversant on offsets than I am, but that's a lot of offsets. Current emissions out there are about covered emissions are about 6 billion tons in the U.S. The Waxman-Markey allows up to 2 billion tons to be submitted as offsets. An offset is basically if you go outside the covered system and you invest in a project to reduce carbon emissions, then you can get credit for that and submit that in lieu of the allowances that you would be submitting. The concern with that, if all those offsets are good, if all those offsets are real and they're additional meaning that they wouldn't have happened otherwise, then it's not really a problem. In fact, it can be very good. It's a good cost control strategy, and it will help developing countries reduce their emissions. But if those offsets are bad, if those offsets are not real, or if they are not additional, you basically undermine your cap, and you increase the cost per ton of abatement. If all of the 2 billion tons of allowances are not real, basically instead of getting a 70% overall reduction in carbon emissions economy-wide, you would get about a 50%. So you still get significant reductions in emissions, even if all those all those offsets are bad. But you certainly don't meet the kind of goals that the administration, the IPCC, and others have been talking about. This just gives you a perspective. I know you can't read the left side here, but at the bottom, this is the change in marginal cost of the allowances resulting from those offsets. So basically, if you didn't have offsets allowed in the system, the marginal cost of abatement would be double. So it's huge. Energy efficiency, just to put it in perspective, the energy efficiency programs in terms of their contribution to cost control of allowances is about 2% relative to 89% for offsets. So you really got to have them. There's no way you're going to negotiate a climate bill without the offsets. But we need to be really vigilant now and going forward to make sure that they're real. And I'll just I will hit these two things. One is one problem with the offsets too that we need to be concerned about is that the offsets require that it be additional savings from baseline. And so if you're giving a country money, if you're giving someone money in a developing country to reduce their emissions, that needs to be emissions reductions that would not have occurred otherwise. If those countries have policies that already reduce the emissions, there's less additional emissions to be gotten by investors in projects. And so that gives an incentive, a perverse incentive, to those countries not to have policies for carbon abatement. And so that's where, you know, there's a lot of discussion right now about a quote-unquote tariff on embodied carbon coming in from countries that do not have carbon policies. And I know that the administration has come out, you know, in opposition to those provisions being in the legislation because they will could undermine negotiations in Copenhagen. But ultimately, you got to do something along those lines. Waxman-Markey has a lot of incentives and carrots to get countries to move forward in terms of reducing their GHG emissions, but you probably are going to ultimately have to have a stick. Maybe somebody will argue with me about that. So, in conclusion, there's a lot of good policy in the American Clean Energy and Security Act. It gets significant GHG reductions, far more significant than any other policy I've ever heard proposed. It addresses energy efficiency market barriers. It's at least cognizant of a lot of key issues. From my view, it's very smart legislation. But we have a to-do list, at least from our perspective, and that's to defend the energy efficiency funding and the policies, to strengthen the renewable energy standard, to ensure that offset quality is good, that there's provisions up front and ongoing to make sure that the quality is good, and to ensure that the end-use price signal isn't muted.
Thank you very much, Joe. And yes, I'm going to corroborate what Joe said. I did tell him, you know, in our discussions on energy security, a lot of people didn't argue with energy efficiency sort of being in that sweet spot in the part that helps your economic concerns, your security concerns, and your environmental concerns. So we thought we knew he had some interesting things to say about pending legislation and policies, so really glad that you did present that. Also, apologize for both of the presentations where you weren't able to see something. I just wanted to let you know that most of the presentations will be posted afterwards, so whatever you weren't able to see on the screens up here today, you can check out on the website afterwards. And finally, our last speaker today is Sarah Forbes from the World Resources Institute. We're really glad she can be here today to talk about carbon capture and sequestration.
Thank you, Sarah. I have the challenge today of talking about a technology that, as Britt and Rick showed in the models, a technology we count on to be a part of the carbon-constrained, energy-secure future, but one that's in a very different stage of development and deployment than the other technologies we've talked about today. I direct our CCS project at the World Resources Institute, and our project is aimed at breaking the barriers for CCS demonstration and deployment. I only have 10 minutes today, and I'm going to try to do a diverse set of things in that time. First of all, we're going to talk just a little bit about CCS and energy security. Second, give you a flavor for where the technology is and where it isn't. I feel there's a lot of misinformation out there on both ends of the spectrum. There are folks saying that you can't do CCS, that it's purely fictional, which isn't true. And then there are also a lot of people saying, well, we can do it right now, today, at scale and deploy it. And I don't think we're quite there yet either. The third thing I'm going to do is I'm going to talk specifically about the American Clean Energy Security Act of 2009 and what the CCS provisions are. And finally, I'm going to talk about international CCS deployment. Ultimately, we need to see a global network of integrated power production and CCS demonstrations, and I'm going to talk about a project that we're working on with China to move towards that. This is why we're here. This is a typical coal-fired power plant. Many Americans don't realize that this is where we get 50% of our electricity in this country. Globally, it's a little bit less than that. China, it's 80%. Those of you who work in the energy industry may know that big black cloud in the front is actually your cooling tower, and that's water vapor, that's not CO2. Nevertheless, CO2 is the primary greenhouse gas, and when you look at the numbers, coal-fired power plants are a major source, and unless we find a climate change solution for coal-fired power plants, we're not going to meet our 450 ppm goals. So moving away from coal, moving towards another world where we use more energy efficiency, where we rely more heavily on renewable energy, is definitely a vision we share. Right now, practically and politically, the U.S. is a key player in coal. We're currently the world's second largest producer and consumer of coal. As I mentioned, 50% of our electricity comes from coal. projections are that for the foreseeable future, we're going to continue to rely on coal, and rightly so. Coal is cheap, it's abundant, and it's domestic. Other countries, you know, in Stephen Chu's Energy Secretary's confirmation hearing, he gave a great quote, and I didn't bring it written down today, but he was asked about CCS technology, and he talked about its importance by tying it to the global consumption of coal, the fact that even if in the U.S. we don't build another coal-fired power plant, and he didn't say it quite like that, but that China, India, Russia are also very coal-dominated electric systems, that globally we're going to continue to use coal. And when we're thinking about climate change, we need to find a way to think about climate change and how to deal with coal. Today, that technology and what we look at is CCS. Our work on CCS at WRI is founded on five guiding principles. These principles serve as a touchstone. I think it's important to acknowledge that you can't do CCS everywhere. The geology isn't going to support it in every location. And our work shows that we think we can do CCS meeting these five principles. They are first and foremost. If you're going to do CCS, you have to do it in such a way that protects human health and ecosystems. Second, ecosystems. Third, underground sources of drinking water. Fourth, must ensure real emissions reductions through appropriate greenhouse gas accounting and monitoring of geologic storage. And fifth, and importantly, we have to facilitate both cost-effective and timely deployment. I mentioned CCS is in a different stage of development than some of the other technologies we've been talking about. The challenge is that if we don't invest in demonstrating the technology today, we're not going to have it in 2020 when we start counting on it as being part of our portfolio. And similarly, if we don't have policies that support its demonstration and deployment, we're not going to have it in the toolbox. So I'd like to ask you all a question, and if you can get a couple responses, that would be great. Well, why aren't we doing CCS today? What's the primary barrier? I heard cost. What else?
No price on carbon.
Excellent. Anyone else? No regulatory framework. Exactly. Lack of environmental and regulatory framework. All great answers. I put some similar ones here. No policy driver. I also added some technological concern. You know, carbon capture is something that we do for refineries. CO2 transport is something we've been doing in the U.S. since the 1970s. And geologic storage is something we know quite a lot about. But when we think about scaling up to a power plant scales, there are additional challenges that come. It costs too much. That's absolutely a big barrier. And the final one that nobody mentioned is social barriers. You know, the barriers to CCS are technological, social, and economic, just like any other technology. One of the things we often throw the public out as a barrier to CCS, and the technical community does it too, the policy, we all do it. We say the public is a barrier, there's a third of a chance we're not going to be able to do this technology because of the public. And I just like to add that NIMBY issues and how the public feels about a technology in their backyard is definitely influenced by your environmental regulatory framework, by, you know, the safety of the technology, and also by the cost. I mentioned that our work at WRI is focused at overcoming the barriers to CCS technology. I'd like to emphasize that with at-scale integrated demonstration of CCS technology, we're going to see technology learning. We're going to work out those issues with scale-up. Costs are going to come down. This isn't an issue that the U.S. or any country can tackle alone. We need to facilitate and envision and make happen an integrated global network of CCS demonstrations. And there are quite a few efforts internationally ongoing. Many of you may know the G8 last July set a goal of 20 demonstrations announced by 2012. The IEA is doing an international CCS roadmap right now. The Australians are taking a lead with their Global Institute. There's a lot of work happening along those lines. But we also have to address the social barriers. We need clear rules for environmental protection. We have the US EPA has a draft rule for underground geologic storage. There are already environmental regulatory frameworks in place in the EU and Australia. We're moving forward, but those clear rules for environmental protection are a key part. We also need to talk about the public. We need to stop thinking about the public as a barrier. One of the things we're doing at WRI is developing a set of guidelines for community engagement around CCS projects. What does a community need to know about the technology, and how do you get past seeing the public as a barrier? Let's talk about the cost. This chart shows some of the most prominent studies that estimate the cost of CCS. I put it up there to emphasize several things. First of all, there's a difference in the cost of CCS when you look at a supercritical pulverized coal plant and an integrated gasification combined cycle plant. Costs are going to be more for a supercritical plant than they are going to be for an IGCC. The costs are also highly uncertain, and there are often these studies. These studies are based on our systems, on system studies of energy systems, and they also have different assumptions. Most of these cost studies are assuming a 90% carbon capture on a plant. They also have some differing assumptions when you look at the transport and storage. The IPCC numbers on the left are arguably not correct because they're in $2,002 dollars, and we know what's happened with economic markets in the meantime. They're the only ones that include only the cost of capture. The MIT numbers, that plus $5 you see at the end, is your cost for transport and storage. NETL and EPRI come on the higher end of the spectrum, and part of the rationale, part of the reason behind that is that they include a nominal cost for transport and storage. Although if you talk to somebody who's actually tried to cost out a transport and storage network, they may tell you that sometimes those numbers are grossly underestimated. Until we do some at-scale demonstrations, until we get that global network of integrated CCS demonstrations up and going, until we do CCS at the millions of tons of CO2 per year, we're not going to have very certain cost estimates. It's definitely an evolving issue. Okay, briefly, the CCS provisions in the American Clean Energy Security Act of 2009. On the WRI website, and I hope we have some copies of them outside, we have a summary that just briefly presents these. I'm going to go through them very quickly. The bill does finalize the environmental regulations for CCS, both the EPA's proposed rule for geologic sequestration and also a broader integrated vision for CCS. An interesting thing, and I think something that recognizes the state we are with technology, is with CCS technology, is the bill requires a formal evaluation of the regulatory framework every 3 years. You know, one of the things we always say about CCS is we need to balance our confidence that we think the technology will work with some humility and that there's a lot about the technology that we don't and can't know until we do it at scale. The bill requires emissions reporting for geologic storage, sets a task force to evaluate legal frameworks. One of the things that's about this task force is it ties heavily at looking at existing legal instruments and thinking through how they can apply to CCS and also addressing some of the long-term stewardship issues. There's a funding mechanism for demonstrations through a new corporation that would be managed by the Electric Power Research Institute. There are bonus allowances for early deployments of CCS. And importantly, the bill sets performance standards for new coal-fired power plants. I'm going to talk a little bit more in detail about that. The performance standards in the House version of the bill, plants permitted from 2009 to 2020 must achieve a 50% reduction in annual CO2 emissions by 2025. That would happen earlier if CCS were deployed at significant scales prior to 2025. Plants permitted from 2020 onward would have to achieve a 65% reduction in annual CO2 emissions. So some pretty significant reductions. How can you meet those? I think CCS is an important option. The bill doesn't specify that those reductions have to be made through CCS. So you could do biomass co-firing. There are some other opportunities that could be utilized to meet those goals in the language that I read. And I'd be interested if anyone has alternate views on that. I said we would talk briefly about China. So WRI worked on a report developing guidelines for CCS. It was a stakeholder process, took over 2 years. When we started it, we weren't sure that we could arrive at clear rules for how to responsibly deploy CCS. Our stakeholder group worked together, and we drafted a pretty comprehensive set of rules and recommendations for regulators, for potential operators, for best practices, and also for Congress in terms of considerations for how to do CCS and how to do it right. If we don't have a solution for coal in China, we likely don't have a solution for climate change. So we're working with Tsinghua University under an APP project to look at what an environmental regulatory system for CCS might look like in China. The effort is a WRI-Tsinghua partnership, and it's led by a steering committee that's comprised of U.S. and Chinese experts on CCS technology. This picture was taken last week. Our American delegation went to China. We met with the Chinese members of the steering committee, and we had the opportunity to see firsthand what China is doing on CCS. This picture is of our team, and it was taken at the GreenGen construction site. So I said that I've talked why we're working in China. I'd like to leave you with the fact that China's industry leaders are moving forward on CCS technology now, and here's how. Kwanang is, I showed you the picture of the GreenGen site. They recently have received the final approval to begin construction of a 250-kilowatt IGCC. And that's the first phase of the project. The second phase of the project is going to start in 2014. There are CCS considerations planned for CCS in that phase and also an additional 400 megawatts. Outside Beijing, Huanang has a very small capture plant. It's 3,000 tons. It was an effort that was sponsored by the Australians. It's very small capture, but that type of showcase is important in showing the feasibility of integrated capture with power. There's a planned project in Shanghai for 10,000 tons of CO2 per year. That CO2 will be sold to the beverage industry, ultimately released to the atmosphere, but hopefully offsetting CO2 that would otherwise be taken from natural sources. Shenhua, China's biggest coal company, the world's biggest coal company, has announced official plans to do a CCS demonstration in a saline formation, which is your CO2 storage, not CO2 storage via EOR, at a direct coal liquefaction plant in Inner Mongolia within the next 2 years. And PetroChina has pilot projects underway looking at CO2 EOR. Not only are they looking at CO2 EOR from an oil recovery standpoint, they're also tracking the CO2, adding tracers, monitoring what happens to the CO2 after injection. These are investments that are being made specifically on the storage side directly from the Chinese enterprises with some support from foreign governments, but primarily Chinese-led. So in this presentation and in all of our analysis, we always effectively wed CCS to coal. And we do that because coal is important from a climate change perspective. It's important from our energy security standpoint, and it's an important fuel for this country and for others. But CCS as a technology, it's important to remember, it's not about coal. It's about climate change. And there are opportunities to deploy CCS with other point sources. The industrial projects that we have ongoing today are mostly with natural gas refineries. Some of the Department of Energy's regional partnership projects are doing field demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of tons of CO2 from an ethanol facility. You can also use cement and fertilizer manufacturers. So there are a number of relatively pure sources of CO2 that are CCS ready that don't specifically tie to coal. And thinking about CCS from a perspective, we have to work towards integrated demonstrations of the technology, but also not ignore the near-term opportunities. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. That was great. We've got an ample amount of time for a question and discussion, which is good. I just wanted to say, you know, one of the purposes of us doing this brief, there are a number of them, but in the cooperation that we had struck with the World Resources Institute, the goal was always to sort of bring together the environmental community and the security community on perspectives on climate change and energy security. And one of the things we had noticed was happening was that energy security was sort of having this very isolated conversation about oil security. And that was largely a product of the times. You know, high oil prices will get people focused on the price of gasoline and the price of oil globally. But we wanted to expand the discussion to look at other aspects of energy security. Because what we're really talking about is transforming an entire energy system, and it really requires sort of a broader public appreciation of some of the security dimensions that go into producing affordable and reliable energy to everybody. So we really appreciate a lot of the feedback that we've gotten on how our metrics were great, how they were bad, how they should be weighted. It's been, for us, a think tank that likes to stimulate ideas and instigate conversations, a really fruitful engagement for us that we hope to continue. I'd like to encourage all of you again to ask some questions. Again, the ground rules are please state your name and state your question in the form of a question. I am going to open it up quickly, though. I wanted to know if, from your perspective, a lot of the papers that we were writing when we were looking at this and the work that we did on this brief were predicated on long-term forecasts for energy that didn't take into account a global economic crisis and a capital crisis. And to what extent, sort of in the near term, have those types of both sort of the current economic climate, this uncertainty going forward, impacted your individual sort of technology progress for the good or ill, depending on what it is? And do you think that that will have an effect on sort of the long-term ability to meet some of these more ambitious goals, whether it be scaling up nuclear or deploying CCS or getting to efficiency goals like we'd like to see? And that's for any of you. Yep.
Sure.
On the efficiency side, it can cut both ways, and on the energy demand side, it cuts both ways. As I said earlier, the projections are about 15% lower GDP now than just 2 years ago, and that has profound effect. It has greater effects on energy demand than anything else you can do. Having said that, there's also, I don't know if you've seen reports over the last few days, there's slower, as a result, turnover of capital. And so people are buying fewer cars and buying fewer houses, which means that the rate of efficiency improvement coming from buildings or cars is slower. And right now, a number of cities are concerned about meeting their air quality standards because of vehicle sales having gone down. Apparently, vehicles now are 6 months older. The average vehicle on the road now is 6 months older than it was just a couple of years ago. And so that has adverse impacts on energy efficiency.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. I'd like to weigh in as well. The Nuclear Energy Institute sees an opportunity, really, that this slowdown actually gives us a little breathing room. We are faced with several challenges. One is a supply chain challenge that we have really lost some of our global capacity to produce components, and we also have new regulatory approaches that we've been working on for a while, and we're anxious to try them out, and we're confident that they will be an improvement, but they will inevitably take longer than we'd hope. And finally, there's also a workforce issue that we've identified in the early 2000s and have been working on, and we've got that moving in the right direction, but a few more years doesn't hurt. The good news is our existing fleet of 104 plants in this country, over 50% of them now have had their licenses extended for an additional 20 years. That also will buy us a little bit of breathing space. And nothing like a recession to cut down your emissions, too. So,
Probably as a benchmark, wind industry, AWEA, estimates that the installation of wind capacity will drop from 8,000 megawatts last year to just 5,000 megawatts this year. And if you've been following it, wind's been growing pretty steadily at about 40% a year unless the production tax credit expires. So you can see some impact from that. And I think to the extent that the credit markets recover and go back to where they were, then that'll be a short-term blip. But wind and solar and those things are capital-intensive programs, and they depend upon a substantial amount of capital available to fund that. So I think the health of the credit markets, the capital markets, is very much of concern to the people in the renewable energy industry.
From a CCS perspective, one of the things that we've seen as a result of the economic crisis, we've seen stimulus bills in a number of countries. And CCS has played a prominent role in those stimulus bills. In the U.S. bill, we had one of the slides earlier today showed $3.4 billion for fossil energy. That money goes towards CCS research, $1 billion of it for the FutureGen project. You also have active RFPs out for Canada. Europe has an active RFP for CCS demonstrations for $1.5 billion. Australia recently in their financial budgeting process, allocated $2 billion, and those are converted to U.S. dollars, $2 billion to do large-scale 2,000 to 4,000 megawatt integrated CCS demonstrations. So from a CCS standpoint, we have seen some government investment in CCS as a direct result of the stimulus packages.
Hi, I'm Tim Stryker with USGS. I work in international affairs. And my question, I guess, was for Sarah or the other panelists, because we're obviously the big consideration is what level of confidence do we have in verifying the amount of carbon that is being stored or being released as a way to support regulatory regimes both in the United States and in other countries? And it seems that not much can be done just on a national basis if you're going to have global carbon markets and exchanges, that this needs to be seamless on an international basis. So I was wondering, in terms of the experience that you have, what you see happening in other countries what we can learn from each other in doing this, and what's the time frame for us to really need to have something in place to have an impact in reducing emissions, and what's the tipping point among all these countries in terms of making something globally effective and implementable?
I'll answer that specifically from a CCS perspective, and I'm sure others will want to weigh in. From a CCS perspective, the monitoring of CO2 once it's in storage is really essential. It's essential from an accounting standpoint, ensuring real reductions, but it's also essential from an environmental standpoint. You have to do a risk assessment, and you need to monitor. We are seeing environmental regulatory frameworks emerge at the national level in Europe and Australia. We have the US EPA proposal. The good news is that there's quite a bit of consistency among those regulatory frameworks and quite a bit of consistency. And really, I see a convergence of ideas for how to responsibly, from an environmental standpoint, manage CCS. On the accounting side, there have been some discussions about an ISO standard for CCS. I think that first we need to see true knowledge sharing associated with demonstrations. And that, but I think that an ISO standard would be in reach at some point.
I'll just say there's uncertainty with all of these technologies, and including energy efficiency. And the only way that we're going to know is by doing it and going forward and make it less uncertain.
Okay, right there.
Hi, I'm Samir Nazir. I'm actually interning here at the Department of Transportation at the Department of State as well. Question for Mr. Genoa. With reprocessing fuel, that elicits concerns about, you know, use of that fuel for weapons applications and things like that. But the flip side of that is we don't get the negative complications that we get from having to mine more nuclear fuel. Is there going to be any motion, maybe from a policy standpoint, to move towards reprocessing more fuel? Or is it just too much of a security risk? Or is there a lot of myth to that? Just wondering if you could comment on that.
Sure. Thank you. I think the short answer is that certainly we see opportunities to recycle used fuel in the future in a way that both reduces proliferation risk and extracts about the 95% of energy left in that fuel after we use it, and further rendering what is left over, and there always will be something left over that needs to go into a repository, making that a more manageable process for disposal. The U.S. government, I think in the Energy and Water Appropriations Bill that was passed, I think, yesterday, that includes a substantial amount of money. I can't remember now. I think I won't quote on the number, but a substantial amount of funding through the Department of Energy to the national labs to continue advanced fuel cycle initiatives, which look into those opportunities. But this is a slightly longer-term project. We're not looking at this being economically feasible near-term, and there is both R&D and then deployment at a pilot scale to be done first. So, yes, lots of opportunity. And it is moving forward, but it isn't happening anytime soon in the United States.
I think you were first, Deb.
Hi, I'm Charles Newstead from the State Department. Sorry for the gravelly voice. Now, actually, I work in many of these areas we're talking about because I'm first put my cards on the table. I'm a nuclear physicist. So I'm not afraid of radiation, and I understand the nuclear power cycle, and I also work on nuclear nonproliferation at the State Department. So I can say that that's really, nonproliferation is not a problem with expanding nuclear power. I think we can handle that. And secondly, as far as reprocessing goes, we have to do that carefully, so we have to be a little more careful about economics, which has always been a question. But certainly, at the moment, we don't even need to do that because we have plenty of uranium, and we can certainly have all the fuel. And with somebody mentioned blending down Russian weapons-grade uranium, that's also a very good thing to do. But that's not the question I wanted to ask. I really want to concentrate on Mr. Genoa and ask him, given the fact that we've unfortunately let ourselves go and not built reactors for, I forget how long it is, whether it's 20 years or 30 years, we don't have any more new ones. And, of course, there's a whole development of more safer reactors, which everybody's champing at the bit to build. What I'm wondering is how long will it take before those can be licensed and put online, that is built, and so begin contributing to producing electricity in order to begin to help the carbon sequestration problem. And then it's basically coming back to the fact that nuclear power does not produce greenhouse gases. So that's a big benefit. Mm-hmm. And so the question would be, what do you see as the timeline for that?
Yes, certainly. Thank you for that question. Currently, we have 17 companies in consortium that have submitted license applications to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for the review of license application review for a total of 27 new nuclear power plants. Now, let me set the expectation. We believe that somewhere between 4 and 8 of those reactors will be online nominally in the 2016-17 time period. If that, what we're calling the first wave, is done right, meaning that the cost estimates are held reasonably closely, the schedules are held properly, that the regulatory process that we have every confidence will work right does, then we will have 20 more reactors already licensed and ready to deploy. And so there is going to be a slow start, slower than many of us would like, but the reality is we have to get the first ones right. It's important. And if we do a good job, then we will be able to rapidly ramp up. But let me be clear, even if we achieve very rapid ramp-up rates, we will only be a small portion of the solution, and that every other technology sitting up here needs to do heavy lifting in the same way. So this is a big challenge. We're all working hard to make sure it works, and we're pretty confident that we're going to get our wedge taken care of. Thank you.
As a follow-up, can I just ask, what do we do in the meantime since you cited that gap dramatically? What's the mix of energy production sources that you people would recommend?
We currently don't have a problem with installation of renewable energy at a scale that keeps up with load growth at this point. At some point, we are going to have control and system issues, but everything we're seeing right now says with current technology, we can probably go to about a 20% mix of renewable energy, primarily wind, in the load mix before you start having real concerns about control. So I think we've got a ways that we can go on renewable energy. And as I said, last year we put in the equivalent, the capacity equivalent, not the energy equivalent, but the capacity equivalent of probably 5 to 6 nuclear plants. So you can, and that's scaling up, and that can go, that could double or triple. I mean, that's the same engineering construction companies that build coal-fired plants and install natural gas-fired plants install wind turbines. So in reality, do we have the delivery capability? The answer is yes. And to the extent that we've, I'll throw a bone to the natural gas industry, they're also able to respond very quickly with the packaged natural gas plants. So I don't think we're facing a situation like we were back in the mid-70s when we were having brownouts and things like that because load growth was so fast that we couldn't keep up with it. Low growth, and then we probably ought to hear from the Alliance here because there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of conservation out there too.
Yeah, and as an energy efficiency advocate, I'm not supposed to be quite so balanced, but it's my economics background that tells me go get the prices right and all the prices right. If we have an externality cost associated with nuclear or CCS or anything else, you got to deal with that as well and address those market barriers. But otherwise, let the economy decide what's going to, you know, what's going to win and succeed out there. Yeah. Don't tell my boss I said that.
Weta Mazzetti again, and this is like not an official question from the Department of Defense. This is something I wonder about personally. It seems to me that we're out of sync on these geological CCS projects, that the point is to keep the carbon in the ground for thousands of years. I know the EPA is worried about the seals. I mean, how complicated are the analysis? How far do you see the political will going in terms of observation technology? I mean, if you have a seal and you have a water table in a particular area, if you have an earthquake, if you have drying through climate, I mean, the conditions are going to change, and we need this stuff to stay down there for thousands and thousands of years. So how detailed is the analysis? How long do you think these tech demonstration I mean, it seems to me they need to be at least 15 years or at least a decade, and this is something I'm worried about.
That's a great question, and I think it is something to be concerned about. That said, I do think that we have the tools to monitor and track the CO2, and they're tools that we're already using in the oil and gas industry. Our stakeholder group really taught me, and in leading that effort, really taught me that we know enough to move forward with at-scale demonstration. But it's about balancing that confidence with the humility, and that's why I think the periodic reevaluation of the EPA rule is really something that's significant. You mentioned earthquakes and a concern about earthquakes. The presence of seismicity shouldn't rule out a site, but you have to do a comprehensive risk assessment. And this is something that we can do and that, you know, but it costs money. So you have to collect, before you choose a site, you have to collect data at that site. And then you have to use that data and feed it back into your model and your understanding of the site. And at the same time, use that data to evaluate the risks and have plans to address any risks if they occur. Also important and implicit in your question is the issue of long-term stewardship. And that's something that we all still have some questions about. In Europe, they have a 30-year time frame where the operator has to pay for monitoring. And they also have very clear rules for when the responsibility transfers away from the operator to the responsible entity. Australia takes a different approach. The US EPA draft proposal said 50 years. The WRI guidelines use a performance-based approach in which the group, as a group, the stakeholders outlined 6 criteria. And if an operator can prove that these 6 criteria are met, and it includes things like showing where the CO2 plume is, showing that it's not going to leak in the future, really a robust set of framework. But the idea is if you can meet those performance criteria, that you can show that the site will not pose a risk to human health or the environment in the future. You have to have policies. Well, one of the things that we have seen in the Senate is a proposed bill, S-1013, that provides liability protection for the first 10 projects where the government would take liability. Our stakeholder group talked a lot about post-closure stewardship and liability, and we had stakeholders on vastly different ends of the spectrum. I think that a plan that addresses the first demonstration projects, and 10 is a great number, I think that type of a plan is where we could get agreement among a diverse set of stakeholders that, okay, you know, we don't know enough to set, you know, to set a policy that's going to be enacted forever into the future, and we don't want to take on some of the legacies that we've had with other issues, but, you know, let's figure it out, the liability for these first 10. The Australians are treating it much like other industries, but, you know, everyone's struggling with the post-closure stewardship, and we have different timeframes. We have a website out that you can look at the guidelines and different regulatory frameworks and look at specifically post-closure stewardship and pull the language for how it, if that's helpful.
Actually, I have a sort of a follow-up on that. A couple of years ago, we had there was a seminar here on China's energy use, and people were thinking, my God, China seems to be, are we talking about peak coal? And, you know, as an energy economist, somebody until very recently was just worried exclusively where are we going to get the fossil fuels. It's very hard for me to imagine that human emissions of fossil fuels are going to peak much later than the end of the century. And two centuries from now, it's very hard for me to imagine that even if we still want to, we won't have run out, essentially run out of any economic deposits of coal. So the question is, assume we sequester a trillion tons of CO2, and it starts to leak out over 1,000 years, and we get a couple billion tons of CO2 leaking out long after we've given up conventional fire. Why would that make a difference? Why are people worried about hundreds of years or tens of thousands of years?
I think it gets implicit in if you leave coal underground in the first place, you don't have any emissions. And I just would like to emphasize that if you site a project correctly, if you operate it responsibly, and if you monitor it, our stakeholders universally believe that you should be able to keep the CO2 in storage. But there are always incidents, and we know that. I think that having mitigation and contingency plans in place, the scenarios where you have billions of tons leaking 1,000 years from now are just not consistent with our understanding of the geology and the trapping mechanisms and what keeps the CO2 underground. The risk of CO2 in the subsurface, your primary risk of leakage is going to be during your operation and injection. After you stop injecting, your CO2 plume is going to stabilize and storage becomes more and not less secure through time.
But, I mean, are you creating an extra problem that you don't need to worry about when you set a standard 10,000 years?
Our stakeholders didn't support setting a standard of a certain number of years, not even for monitoring. Mm-hmm. Our stakeholders set a standard of focusing on the criteria that you care about. Let's show that the CO2 is there. Let's show that it's going to stay there and that it's not going to harm the environment or human health in the future. That was the approach. Our stakeholder group did not support such a standard.
There was once at a discussion about long-term liability for CCS, and people were trying to find a body that would be analogous to a 10,000 or a thousand, multiple thousands of years or even hundreds of year time frame. And they said, well, companies certainly aren't around that long, and governments aren't even around that long, so maybe we should give it to the churches. Which everyone kind of laughed and said, ooh, let's not go there. So anyway, it's a good question. Ken. Oh, I'm sorry. You can go right after. Sorry.
Thank you. Ken England with the Canadian Embassy. My question is for Mr. Church. If I'm not mistaken, I did see hydro listed among the list of renewables that you had in your presentation, although you didn't elaborate very much on how hydro fits into the broader renewable mix and, I guess, the clean energy vision. I wonder if you could comment on that and also the fact that hydro has been given scant attention in anything that we've seen in Congress.
Well, let me broaden. I use hydro. When we say hydro, we basically mean kinetic energy, water kinetic energy. So that could be wave, it could be flow, tidal. I think the issue we see in the United States is there a modest number of large hydro sites that are feasibly developable at this point. The smaller sites have historically suffered somewhat from economies of scale issues of costs, and I think people are working on that, and there's progress made, and we're putting in small hydro at a modest rate every year in the country. I think probably one of the most exciting things I've seen is people seem to be making some real progress on fish-friendly turbines, and so I see hydro continuing to make a contribution, but I don't see the potential growth that's there because we've essentially pick the low-hanging fruit in this country. I think Canada's got a substantial amount of hydro that they can continue to develop, and I think our challenge with large hydro is to do that in a manner that's environmentally sensitive. That I think, you know, hydro is
well, I guess all forms of renewable energy have their downsides. You know, on the wind side, we're learning to coexist more easily with bats and birds, I think, than the hydro has learned to coexist with salmon. But I think we need to find those balances so that that at the end of the day we meet that social acceptability issue that people can endorse the projects. But I think within the United States, we probably picked the low-hanging fruit there, and there's a substantial amount more to be done, I think, with some tidal and some kinetic flow energy where people are making some exciting technology plays, and I think those will work pretty well. Those because they don't involve dams, or at least low head dams, they usually are much less controversial.
Yes, sir.
Rory Marston from ITT Space Systems again. My question is for Sarah. I found what you said to be fascinating. I'm curious about what you think the real costs will be and if there are actually market leaders in this, or is it just researchers right now saying, okay, we think we can do it?
I think the costs of CCS are always going to be expensive. You know, what the ultimate cost will be, there is a study that Ed Rubin at Carnegie Mellon did several years back that looked at traditional technology learning curves for other environmental controls that we put on power plants and projected for CCS. For each doubling in capacity, there was a commensurate decrease in the cost. If I remember correctly, the overall reduction was about a 20% from where we see now, but I can send you the paper if you're interested in the details.
If it was written by somebody at Carnegie Mellon, can you dumb it down to my level?
I've got a graph. I'll be happy to send you. So that was the first part of your question. What was the second part?
Are there market leaders or just researchers?
So there's both. And I think the researchers definitely are looking at CCS from a climate change perspective. On the market side, you have a couple of actors. You know, you have enhanced oil recovery business. There is the opportunity to use some of the CO2 that you could capture for power plants to recover more oil. There are issues with, you know, are you tracking it for CO2 storage or not? And there's some ideas that, you know, maybe if you just want to do EOR, you shouldn't be subject to rules for, you know, there's some differences between do you want to maximize the CO2 storage or is your ultimate goal EOR? And I think you have some players that are interested in both. You have some businesses that are really building up around monitoring and making sure that CCS is done safely. And there are some leaders in that area. And you also have the oil and gas companies really thinking about CO2 storage as a future business opportunity. Our work in China, those efforts that I said that China's industry is leading, you know, they're getting some government funding, but they're also investing a lot of their own dollars in looking into CCS. And I think that's happening here in the U.S., but it's even happening there.
I know we've got some questions left, but in the interest of timing, getting everyone out of here at a good time on a Friday afternoon, I'm going to wrap up. But I just wanted to thank each of our speakers, both on this panel and on the panel before, for being so generous with their time when there is obviously so much going on in each and every one of their fields to come here and talk with us today. So, again, the presentations will be on the website. We're always happy to hear from you all about the work that we're doing. And I just wanted to ask you to join me in thanking our panel for being here today.